When I began to look at Matthew 26, I said, well, we're going to have to at least cover that. And then we have to cover Matthew 27, too. And then if you really want to be right with the communion message, you have to cover Matthew 28, too. Is it possible to do justice to a study of three chapters? Well, if you remember, I did something similar with Matthew 5, 6, and 7. I didn't break it down because there really are about 25 messages packed in those three chapters. And I think the same is probably true for these three chapters. And so basically what we're going to do, my goal this morning is to, my goal throughout the whole book of Matthew has been to try to focus on Jesus' human side in the sense that we can understand that he really was a man. In fact, I would go so far as to say that the miracle of the incarnation is not so much Jesus' divinity as it is his humanity. The fact that he was able as a divine being to come to earth, clothe himself in our flesh, and limit himself to our limitations, walk around perfectly, and then offer himself as a sacrifice for humankind, to me, is the miracle. And so that's kind of what I want us to do, is to think about Christ in his passion and his humanity. Turn in your Bibles to Matthew 26. I don't think that I'm going to take the time to read the entirety of these chapters. It would be good to do so, but I don't consider myself good enough of a public reader to be able to do the story justice. But if you'll remember, a couple of chapters ago in Matthew, Jesus came into Jerusalem and people were praising him. They were ready to throw down their clothes on the street for his donkey to walk on. And this was quite a day. And in the meantime, we had a lot of things that Jesus had to say. Remember that it was during his last week in Jerusalem that Matthew 23 would have taken place. And that is the condemnation that Jesus gave against the religious leaders. And he also talked about the destruction of Jerusalem and his return. And he talked about the final judgment and different things like that. And now we come to Matthew 26, verse 1, and it says, "And it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said unto his disciples, Ye know that after 2 days is the feast of the Passover, and the Son of Man is betrayed to be crucified. Then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people unto the palace of the high priest, who is called Caiaphas, and consulted that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. But they said, Not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people." And if you keep reading, you'll notice that there's this story in verses 6 through 16 where Jesus is in the house of Simon and a woman comes in with this ointment, very expensive, and the disciples were indignant about this. And they said, she's wasting all this money. And Jesus said, let's read what he said in verse 10. "Why trouble ye the woman? For she hath wrought a good work upon me. For ye have the poor always with you, but me ye have not always. For in that she hath poured this ointment on my body, she did it for my burial. Verily I say unto you, wheresoever this gospel shall be preached in the whole world, there shall also this, that this woman hath done, be told for a memorial of her." I find verse 13 fascinating, that this woman's act of devotion, of consecration, whatever you want to call it, her willingness to give up that expensive ointment for Jesus is indeed a story that is attached to the gospel everywhere you go. And there's so many things we could learn from that. I'll just let you draw your own lessons from that. But what I want to notice next is we have Judas Iscariot in verse 14. It sounds as if he watched this take place of the woman anointing Jesus, and then immediately he goes and makes the deal with the chief priests. And this is what his deal was. He says, "What will you give me if I deliver him to you?" And they said, 30 pieces of silver. And he said, "Deal." And after that, he looked for a time to betray him. Judas, as we go through this story, Judas pops up every once in a while. Here he seems to be so disgruntled about what happened. It seems as if he's becoming disillusioned with Jesus fooling around. It seems as if he was still hoping that Jesus would take charge and that he would bring his kingdom into this, that he would restore the kingdom to Jerusalem. And based on something that pops up later in this passage, I suspect that Judas did not realize he was condemning Jesus to his death. I don't think he knew that that was going to happen. I think he just thought that he was going to try to speed things up. Let's get this show on the road kind of thing. Well, the next thing we'll see there is the Last Supper. Lot of drama at this supper, if you think about it. First of all, we have this thing happening of where are we going to eat it? And who knows who the man was in verse 18. Jesus said, just go into the city to such a man and say unto him, the master saith, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at thy house with my disciples. Maybe Jesus knew the man. Maybe he knew the disciples. Maybe he didn't. It doesn't tell us. I wish so bad sometimes that we knew those little details, because if the man truly did not know anybody, these strangers just walking up and say, by the way, we're using your upper room tonight. Are you okay with that? I mean, they didn't even ask that. They just said, we're going to be there. And it seems as if they must have had a little preparation. I don't know. I don't know all those customs. Perhaps it was okay for people from Galilee to just come into Jerusalem and pick somebody and tell them that they want to have Passover with them. I don't know those details. I'm not sure that they're important. It's just one of those little things that crosses your mind. Well, anyway, they did go to have their Last Supper, verses 20 through 29. You'll notice that they're there. And Jesus tells them that one of these disciples is going to be guilty of betraying him to the authorities. And they began to ask, who is it? And he told them that it's one of you all here. And it's chilling to look at verse 24. He says it had been good for that man if he had not been born. It would be better for Judas if he would have never had any life at all than to be the man that he was at this point. I don't know about you, but I do not want Jesus to say that about me, that it would be better if I had not been born. Well, Judas, some of this just makes me wonder what was going through his mind as well. He says to Jesus, is it I? And he said, you have said. Anyway, then Jesus institutes the first communion. You'll see this in verses 26 and on, how he took the bread, he blessed it, broke it, and gave it to the disciples saying, take, eat, this is my body. Same thing with the cup. He gave thanks, gave it to them, and said, drink ye all of it. This is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many for the remissions of sins. I do not believe that it was any accident that this was taking place at the Passover. I think that God had arranged all of this to let them know that we have a shift going on here, that the Lamb of God is now Jesus Christ, and there will be no more Passovers as they knew it. Verse 30, they sang together, and then they went out to the Mount of Olives. Verse 31 is a fulfilled prophecy. Jesus says, all ye shall be offended because of me this night, for it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered abroad. But after I am risen again, I will go before you into Galilee. I won't turn back to that because it's quoted almost exactly the way it is in the Old Testament, but in Zechariah 13, verse 7, you will find those words about the shepherd being smitten and the sheep being scattered. Well, Peter didn't like the sound of that at all, and he says, I will never be offended because of you. And Jesus said, yes, you will. In fact, before dawn, you're going to deny me three times. And Peter was very offended. He said, that's not true. I'm going to die with you. And all the disciples said they would do that. Well, they go out to the Mount of Olives, and there's a special place called Gethsemane that Jesus comes to, and he takes Peter and James and John. I'm just summarizing verses 36 through 46 now. That he began to pray. And he asked them to stay and watch with him. And he prayed in verse 39, "O my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt." And then he went back and found his disciples asleep, told them to wake up and to pray so that they do not enter into temptation. And he prays again, second time, and again the third time, asking if the cup would pass away. Notice the words do change. He said at first, "If it's possible, let it pass." And then he said, "If it won't pass, except that I drink it, then I'll do it." And he said the same thing in verse 44. Well, then he comes to his disciples and he said, "Why don't you all wake up? Because I am about to be arrested." He didn't say it like that, but that's what he meant. This agonizing in the garden, you begin to get a glimpse of the humanity of Jesus more so than maybe at any other point in his life. I have never faced execution. I don't know what that would be like. I don't know what it would be like to face death, especially when you realize that it is so unjust, that it is so unfair, that it's for these miserable disciples that are sleeping out here that can't even stay awake with you that you're going to do this. Not only that, you know that there's one out there plotting to take your life. He's going to help people catch you. It's easy at this point to look at Jesus and say, well, his divinity, he knows that he's going to have to go through this for a couple of days and then everything's going to be all great and glorious. Well, you know that too, right? You know that if you die in God's will, everything will be okay. But that doesn't stop us from wishing that we didn't have to go through it. And so that's what we see here in Jesus' emotions. He's struggling with the acceptance that his human flesh is going to have to suffer. And suffering beyond anything I know about. Unbelievable. Anyway, the time of this, the best I can tell, is probably somewhere around 9 to midnight, somewhere about that time, just to give you a little idea. And the reason I bring that in is because I do not believe that Jesus slept at all this night. That he goes straight from eating the Passover with his disciples to the garden and then straight from there to trotting all over Jerusalem to these different places. And I don't think he was able to sleep at any point during that time. Even if he had had time to lay down and sleep, based on his struggle here in the garden, I do not know that he would have been able to sleep because of what would have been going through his mind. Well, anyway, moving on. He says, "He is at hand that doth betray me." Verse 47 through 56, we have what happens there in the garden. Judas comes along, and he has a great multitude with swords and staves, and the chief priests and the elders. And Judas came forward and kissed Jesus, and they took him, laid hands on him. Anyway, we have this little episode of one of the disciples drawing a sword and striking off the ear of the high priest's servant. And if you want more details on that, you'll have to read some of the other gospels. You'll find out what the servant's name is, you'll find out who did it, and you'll find out which ear it was too. And so at this point, you know that the disciples are at least near enough that they knew what was happening. Anyway, Jesus at this point, I think it's worth reading his words, because again, imagine the human emotions going on here. Verse 52, "Jesus said unto him, Put up again thy sword into his place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then shall the scriptures be fulfilled that thus it might be?" And I want to just stop there and think about this, because here is proof again of Jesus' divinity. He knew that he could have done this. I don't know that I've ever faced a temptation like that either, because when we go through any little paltry suffering that we go through, if we had the means of pressing a magic button and getting out of it, how many of us would succumb to that? I would. I think I would, given what I know about myself. I think I would probably say, let's end it. We're out of here. I don't care what the scriptures say. I don't care what. I'm saving myself. But Jesus says no, because the scriptures have to be fulfilled. I cannot do that. I cannot yield to the temptation of 12 legions of angels to get me out of this mess. Think how impressive that would be to destroy all those people with 12 legions of angels. But anyway. And then Jesus said, are you come out against a thief? Behold, I sat daily with you in the temple and ye laid no hold on me. But all this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. And at that point, Matthew says, all the disciples forsook him and fled. But you'll notice there in verse 58 then that Peter followed him far off. Peter was scared, but he was also so curious that he had to find out what was going on. And so he stayed way back. And they took him to Caiaphas. Now, I was not able to find a good source of how far Jesus would have traveled this night. That was one of the things that came to my mind, because he goes out to the garden and then he comes back, and John tells us in John 18 that he actually went to Annas' house first and then to Caiaphas' house, and then he went to Pilate, then he went to Herod, and then he went back to Pilate, and then he finally got sentenced to death. I don't know what those distances were. They could not have been huge, but they are also somewhat significant, because I seriously doubt they went any other way than on foot. And if, as you follow the trend of Jesus' suffering, first of all, remember, no sleep. And then you'll find that he's being beaten. We'll get to that in just a little bit. And he was beat twice, I believe. Maybe just once. But he was definitely wearing out. And then he was supposed to carry his cross all the way out to the place of the skull. Well, we know that he didn't make it. But anyway, what about this discrepancy about Annas being the high priest and Caiaphas being the high priest? The best that I could come up with is that the Romans did interfere a little bit with the Jews' religious system, and Annas had been high priest. He was high priest by right of the Jewish religion, but he apparently had done something that the Romans didn't like, and so they deposed him, and they said, you are not high priest anymore, and they appointed Caiaphas to be high priest, who happened to be Annas' son-in-law. Well, the Jews' law says that the high priest is high priest for life, and you don't have two high priests. So they recognized Annas as high priest, but they had to use Caiaphas to get their legal maneuvers done. And so that's why both men show up, and they're both called high priests. And that actually makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know if it's accurate, but it sounds like it would make sense. Well, one of the things that we notice in this whole thing is that the trial was a complete farce. There was no real charge against Jesus. If you'll remember, looking here in verses 59 and on, it says, the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Yea, though many false witnesses came, yet found they none. At last came two false witnesses and said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. And one of the things that I want you to notice there is that to put an innocent man to death is actually a really hard job, because you got to find liars that are good enough to agree. And liars aren't usually very good at keeping their stories straight. And here we have this thing. And it doesn't even seem like this is good enough, because the high priest says to Jesus, answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee? But Jesus held his peace. And the high priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be Christ, the Son of God. And Jesus saith unto him, thou hast said. Nevertheless, I say unto you, hereafter ye shall ye see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, "He hath spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? Behold, now we have heard his blasphemy. What think ye?" They answered and said, "He is guilty of death." Then did they spit in his face and buffeted him, and others smote him with the palms of their hands, saying, "Prophesy unto us, thou Christ, who is he that smote thee?" While this is going on, Peter is still, he's in the palace, and a lady or a girl came in and said, "You were with Jesus." He said, "No, I don't know what you're talking about." And another person came in, another maid saw him, and she said to everybody that's there, "I know that man's a disciple of Jesus. He was with Jesus of Nazareth," and he denied again with an oath, "I do not know the man." And after a while came unto him they that stood by and said to Peter, "Surely thou also art one of them, for thy speech bewrath thee." Then he began to curse and swear, saying, "I know not the man." And immediately the cock crew. And then Peter remembered the words of Jesus, which said unto him, "Before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice." And he went out and wept bitterly. Peter, this part of my thoughts, as I put them down on paper to try to keep track of them, I called it Jesus' trial. Whenever I wrote the first word, the trial of Jesus, I was thinking of the court trial. I was thinking of the hearing, the judgment of Jesus, where there's judges and lawyers and all of that. But as I pondered this last thing, I thought about how we can use the word trial in two ways. I wonder how much Peter added to Jesus' trial by this denial. And in Luke, I think it's Luke, one of the other Gospels mentions that Jesus turned and looked at Peter, and it seemed like that look is what brought the conviction to Peter, and he went out and wept bitterly, it says. One of the things I'll just insert here is that Peter was wrong for what he did. There is no question about it. However, I wonder how much better we would have done. But what we really want to learn from Peter in this story is that there is a proper way to resolve what has been done wrong. And he did it. He was willing to acknowledge that he did wrong, and he went out and wept. And he was healed from his sin, if you will. Matthew 27 now takes us to the morning. All of this was happening at night. And so all the chief priests and elders, verse 1, of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. So you see that they had started this trial with a foregone verdict. It was guilty. There was no witness that could have saved Jesus. There was no defense attorney that was willing to stand up. And so in verse 2, they bound him and led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. And this is where we come back to Judas. Verse 3, "Then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself." And I wish it would say that he wept bitterly, but it doesn't. It says that he took the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "I have sinned in that I have betrayed the innocent blood." And they said, "What is that to us? See thou to that." And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple, and departed and went and hanged himself. And the chief priests took the silver pieces and said, "It is not lawful for them for to put them into the treasury, because it's the price of blood." Now, why didn't they think about it being the price of blood when they gave it to Judas? Now all of a sudden they don't want to touch it because it's the price of blood. I submit to us this morning that when we are so convinced that something has to happen and we are and it's wrong. Okay, it was wrong. And I think the chief priest knew that it was wrong to put Jesus to death. But they were so insistent on that. And when we take that road, just a little plug here, we will lose all common sense. We'll do stuff that makes no sense at all. And this doesn't make sense. Why did they care all of a sudden that it was the price of blood? It was the price of blood the first time around. Well, anyway. And they took counsel and they decided to buy a potter's field. And you notice in verse 9 that there was another prophecy being fulfilled. You'll find that in Jeremiah 18. Also some reference to that in Jeremiah 19 as well. Anyway, Judas's end is horrible. It seems as if he realized that he was not helping the situation, and that's why he decided that he would end it all, because it seemed that there was no way out. I think the reason that Judas took this route instead of doing what Peter did is because this was the path Judas had been on for a while. He had already been taking money and covering it up. He had already been doing things that he knew was wrong. And finally, he did something that he thought there was no way back. And he decided that the easiest way out is just to die. And it wasn't, unfortunately. But he didn't find that out until it was too late. Whereas Peter, with all his blundering, and maybe he wasn't such a blunderer, maybe he was just a courageous man. But he had, up to this point, had always come to Jesus for the answers, and that's why I believe he made the decision that he did. Anyway, we're at verse 11. Jesus stood before the governor, which was Pilate, and from here, Pilate, it sounds as if you read Matthew from verses 11 to 14, and then you'll see verses 15 on to 16, there's no mention of Jesus going to Herod. Matthew does not record that, and I'm not sure why, but if you go to Luke, there's an extra little twist to this story. Okay, we have Jesus standing before Pilate, and let's read what Matthew has to say. And Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, saying, "Art thou the king of the Jews?" And Jesus said unto him, "Thou sayest." And when he was accused of the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. Then said Pilate unto him, "Hearest thou not how many things they witness against thee?" And he answered him never a word, insomuch that the governor marveled greatly. Anyway, in Luke, if you want to turn there and check it out for yourself sometime, at about this point, somewhere along the way, it came out that he was from Galilee. And it seems as if Pilate jumped on that as an opportunity to get out of this sticky situation, because it's obvious that Pilate did not want to put him to death, but it's equally obvious that he was scared to death of the Jews. And so he said, "Oh, he's from Galilee. Well, that's Herod's problem." And so he sends him off to Herod. And Herod was suited to get him, because it says in Luke that he would hope to see some miracle of him. Well, it's interesting when you read through that Luke passage that Jesus didn't say a word to Herod. He spoke a little bit to Pilate, but he did not say one word to Herod. And it's just interesting, and it made Herod mad, and they ended up there putting a robe on him, and the soldiers mocked him. And then Herod said, "Well, he's not my problem. Send him back to Pilate." And another interesting thing is that it says at that point in Luke that Pilate and Herod were good friends after that. And before that, they weren't friends. You can make of that whatever you want to. But anyway, so he comes back to Pilate. And I'm going to suggest that between verses 14 and 15 is where Luke's story about Herod would come in. It's just kind of the feeling I get. So in verse 15, Pilate has Jesus back. And it's at this feast, apparently the Romans and Jews had made this little agreement that at this feast they would give up one of their prisoners, because the Jews were a volatile bunch and they had a couple of uprisings. And they would probably jail these prisoners as political prisoners. They may not have really been criminals in the eyes of the Jews. And so they would bargain with the Jews by giving one of their prisoners back. And so Pilate had a notable prisoner, it says, that he was called Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a bad man. He was, I believe he was a murderer. another gospel talks about him. And I think Pilate did this on purpose because he knew that Jesus was innocent of what he was. He was not a criminal. But here he had a criminal. And so he says to the Jews, what do you want here? I'm going to release a prisoner. How about Jesus? Or maybe you want Barabbas. And I think he set it up that way to try to get himself out of the bind. Well, the Jews didn't go the way he wished that they would. They said, we want Barabbas. And maybe we should just read this, starting in at verse 17. Therefore, when they were gathered together, Pilate said unto them, whom will ye that I release unto you, Barabbas or Jesus, which is called Christ? For he knew that for envy they had delivered him. When he was set down on the judgment seat, his wife sent unto him, saying, have thou nothing to do with that just man? For I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor answered and said unto them, whether of the twain will ye that I release unto you? They said, Barabbas. Pilate saith unto them, what shall I do then with Jesus, which is called Christ? They all say unto him, let him be crucified. And the governor said, why? What evil hath he done? But they cried out the more, saying, let him be crucified. When Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but that rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. See you to it. Then answered all the people and said, his blood be on us and on our children. Then released he Barabbas unto them. And when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. Now, I haven't been turning back into the Old Testament much, but I do want to take you back to a passage in Deuteronomy chapter 21. I never knew this before until I was studying this, and I saw this connection. Deuteronomy 21, and I'm just going to read verses 1 through 9, and think about what Pilate just did. Deuteronomy 21, verse 1. If one be found slain in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee to possess it, lying in the field, and it be not known who hath slain him, then thy elders and thy judges shall come forth, and they shall measure unto the cities which are round about him that is slain. And it shall be that the city which is next unto the slain man, even the elders of that city, shall take a heifer, which hath not been wrought with, and which hath not drawn in the yoke. And the elders of that city shall bring down the heifer into a rough valley, which is neither eared nor sown, and shall strike off the heifer's neck there in the valley. And the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for them the Lord thy God hath chosen to minister unto him, and to bless in the name of the Lord, and by their word shall every controversy and every stroke be tried. And all the elders of that city that are next unto the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer that is beheaded in the valley, and they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, neither have our eyes seen it. Be merciful, O Lord, unto thy people Israel, whom thou hast redeemed, and lay not innocent blood unto thy people of Israel's charge, and the blood shall be forgiven them. So shalt thou put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you, when thou shalt do that which is right in the sight of the Lord. What was Pilate doing? I think he knew exactly what he was doing. And the thing that makes this even worse is that the Jews knew exactly what he was doing too. And not only that, they said, that's fine. We'll take the innocent blood on ourselves. What a horrible thing to say. These people really don't make any sense. Well, we move into this thing of crucifixion. I do not know that it shows up anywhere else in the Bible until we get here in Matthew. In other words, capital punishment in the Old Testament was not crucifixion. Where did crucifixion come from? I'm not sure. History says that it was somewhere in Asia Minor that people began to crucify for capital punishment. The Romans apparently picked it up, and they became very good at it. I do not want to dwell on the gruesomeness of crucifixion, and yet we are so insulated from death. It would be interesting to ask you, how many of you have even watched someone die in a hospital bed in relative comfort? And compare that to our Savior dying the death of a criminal, and it was not even something as humane as a bullet in the brain. This was horrible. Why did they do this? What were the Romans thinking? Well, the Roman government was a big government, and they had a lot of things at stake. And one of the things they could not afford was uprisings. If they were to keep their, if they were to keep order and they were to keep law, you had to make examples of people. In fact, at one point in Roman rule, there was an uprising of the slaves. And I believe my numbers are right. I think they crucified like over 6,000 people over that thing. 6,000 people. That would wipe out Tylertown. Not only that, this was not something that was done quietly in a dungeon. This was on the main highway. They would string these, they had these poles set up. And I have a feeling that slave owners made sure that their slaves walked out there and took a look, because this is what happens to slaves that think that they're going to get out of this. Well, one of the other things I learned in studying this whole thing is that they wanted to be able to do this efficiently. A crucifixion team was made up of 5 people. There were 4 people that did the actual job, and then the 5th man was a centurion who was to verify that the person actually died, and he carried the official report back to the government that executed the, or that sentenced the man to execution, and verified that yes, he died, he's dead. And what I wanted to notice here is in verse 26, he scourged Jesus. Now, did he scourge Jesus just because he wanted to, or was it because this was part of crucifixion? The other thing is that in another gospel, it seems as if Pilate had him scourged twice. I'm not sure about that, but there was a time that he just said, "We'll beat him and let him go." And no, that's not good enough. He has to be crucified. So I don't know if he actually got scourged twice or just once. It's a little sketchy on that. Now, a Roman scourging is nothing to be laughed at either. In fact, some people never made it to the cross because they died during the scourging. There was a couple reasons that people were scourged. Primarily, it was to weaken the person so that the time on the cross wasn't as long. Also, to weaken the person so that whenever you were nailing him onto the cross, he wouldn't fight you back. These men were very brutally good at what they did. They knew exactly what they could do. And it was 40 lashes with a whip that the Romans made up. It had several lashes on it, and they would weave sometimes metal, sometimes bone, sometimes different things in it. And I won't get any more gruesome than that, but you can just imagine what would happen if you did that 40 times across someone's back from their neck all the way to their ankles, and what kind of blood letting that would have been. Add to that, Jesus hadn't slept. And I'm trying to bring this into perspective, because it's easy to read this because the Bible sanitizes it, and he probably should, and maybe the preacher shouldn't unsanitize it, I don't know. But let's think about what our salvation really did cost. That's what we're here to commemorate this morning, is the fact that Jesus did this so that you and I could be saved. Well, anyway, one of the other things that they did here, and this is not a normal procedure of Roman execution, but in verses 27 down through 29, you'll notice that they began to mock him. They put on this crown of thorns, and they hit him over the head with a reed as he was wearing this crown of thorns, and they were making fun of him being the king of the Jews. So anyway, they led him away, and as I told you before, they were supposed to carry the person that was being crucified was supposed to carry their cross. Now, it was not the entire cross and stipes or whatever they call that, the part that's in the ground. That part just stayed out there all the time. They just left them planted in the ground. So they probably had hundreds of them out there because of that time they crucified 6,000 people. And so all they would carry was the cross beam that held the hands. But some scholars think that it could have weighed up to 100 pounds, which very likely could. If you would imagine even a 6x6 in our dimensional lumber, about 5.5 feet long, it could probably weigh 80 to 100 pounds, depending on different things. But anyway, Jesus couldn't carry it. In verse 32, you'll find that they came out of the city and they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name, and they made him carry the cross instead. I often wondered what happened to Simon later. There's a mention of a Simon in the book of Romans that some people think might have been this Simon. I don't know. I wonder if it had any impact on his future. But anyway, they came to this place, and this vinegar with gall was actually supposed to be like a mild pain reliever. And he didn't take it. Jesus was going to suffer to the fullest with no help to bear it. And so again, verse 35, and they crucified him. It's just a statement. We don't really understand what went into that. I don't understand what went into that. And if you'll bear with me, just a few other little thoughts that to prove that this was no easy death. There's a little discrepancy. It talks about the nail holes in Jesus' hands, and then there's these scientists that say it can't be in the hands because this is all just flesh and tendons, and so it would tear out. Because they've done scientific studies that if you have your hands out at the angle that the Romans would have crucified, that as the weight is added, there's something about that angle that you would think that the weight gets divided in half over your hands, but actually it doesn't. Some scientific geometrical law says that all the weight hangs from both hands. So if I weigh X amount of pounds, I would actually have that hanging from both hands. Each hand would support that much weight. Anyway, there's actually a hole, though. One of the other things that's interesting, I never thought of this before until I was researching this, you actually have some pretty major arteries and veins and stuff that go through here. Well, if you punctured those, then the victim would die really quick. Well, they didn't want their victims to die really quick. And so they actually had to know something about anatomy. And the suggestion is that they actually went into the palm and then at an angle down through the wrist bone, there's a hole in there. And it would pass the arteries, but it would go right across what is called your median nerve. Now, if you want to know about your median nerve, take your elbow and crack it on the edge, and you'll find out real quick that there's a nerve that sends that tingling. We call it, what is it? Your funny bone. Okay, it feels weird. But if that was sustained, it would actually hurt really bad. And that's what they were doing right there. They were hitting that nerve. And so that pain would have just constantly been there. Again, I'm not trying to gross anybody out. I'm just trying to put into perspective the humanity of Jesus. Jesus did not escape human suffering because he was divine. This was real stuff. This was why in the garden he said, God, please, I can't do this. But he did it anyway. Well, you'll notice that there's another prophecy in verse 35. The prophet was actually David. In Psalm 22, it talks about parting the garments among them and casting lots for his vesture. Anyway, so then they they sat down there and watched him. And verse 37 is another little thing that the Romans would do. They would announce the crime of the person on a little board hung on the cross. And Jesus' crime was that he was the King of the Jews. And another gospel tells us that the Jews didn't want that to be up there. And Pilate said, that's what I wrote. So it was no There's no changing it. We also know that there were two thieves crucified with him. And we know that another gospel records the conversation that the thieves had and how one ended up defending Jesus, saying that we deserve to be here. Jesus doesn't deserve to be here. And his, I guess what you would call deathbed conversion. Maybe I'll just read, starting in at verse 38. Then were there two thieves crucified with him, one on the right hand and another on the left. And they that passed by reviled him, wagging their heads and saying, Thou that destroyest the temple and buildest it in 3 days, save thyself. If thou be the Son of God, come down from the cross. Likewise also the chief priests, mocking him with the scribes and elders, said, He saved others, himself he cannot save. If he be the King of Israel, let him come down. Let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him. He trusted in God. Let him deliver him now, if he will have him. For he said, I am the Son of God. The thieves also, which were crucified with him, cast the same in his teeth. Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land unto the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And you'll find these verses also in Psalm 21. There is a doctrine, a theology out there that God did forsake Jesus. But 1 Corinthians tells us that God was in Christ on the cross. And so God was not forsaking Jesus. Again, I believe this points to the human emotion side of Jesus. And one of the other things that it teaches us about emotions is that emotions are not what we use to establish fact. Okay, when we're in the middle of something and we feel like God has forsaken us, that is not true. Unless we have forsaken God. But anyway, that's kind of a side note. Some of them that stood there when they heard it said, This man calleth for Elias. And straightway one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a reed and gave him to drink. The rest said, Let be. Let us see whether Elias will come to save him. Jesus, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom. And the earth did quake, and the rocks rent, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints which slept arose and came out of the graves after his resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared unto many. Now with the centurion and they that were with him, watching Jesus, saw the earthquake and those things that were done, they feared greatly, saying, Truly, this was the Son of God. Notice you see the centurion there, and it was his job again to verify the death of Jesus. Well, verse 55, And many women were there beholding afar off, which followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering unto him, among which was Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's children. When the even was come, there came a rich man of Arimathea, named Joseph, who also himself was Jesus' disciple. He went to Pilate and begged the body of Jesus. Then Pilate commanded the body to be delivered. And when Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in a linen cloth, clean linen cloth, and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out in the rock. And he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulchre and departed. And there was Mary Magdalene and the other Mary sitting over against the sepulchre. Now again, Matthew leaves a few details out. There's other gospels that tell us that they would have broken Jesus' legs to try to speed the death up, but when they came to him, he had already died, and so they speared him in the side. I think that was John that told us that. Another thing that you'll find is when Joseph comes to Pilate, Pilate said, Is he really dead already? And the centurion verified, Yeah, he's dead. So Jesus, I submit to you, did not actually die. His life was not taken from him. I believe he gave it. It was his power to lay it down, and we find out later that it was his power to take it back up. Only Jesus could do that. We can't necessarily do that. But Jesus suffered. He gave himself as the sacrifice, the ransom for sin. And so there was no reason for him to continue suffering. He simply gave his life for us after going through all of that. Well, I'm going to just keep reading. And I think what I'll do now is just read pretty much the rest of the book of Matthew and may make a few comments here and there. Verse 62. Now, the next day that followed the day of the preparation, the chief priests and Pharisees came together unto Pilate, saying, "Sir, we remember that this deceiver said while he was yet alive, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' Command, therefore, that the sepulcher be made sure until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away, and say unto the people, 'He is risen from the dead.' So the last error shall be worse than the first." Pilate said unto them, "Ye have a watch. Go your way, make it as sure as you can." So they went and made the sepulcher sure, sealing the stone and setting a watch. In the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulcher. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it. His countenance was like lightning and his raiment white as snow. And for fear of him, the keepers did shake and became as dead men. And the angel answered and said unto the women, Fear not ye, for I know that ye seek Jesus, which was crucified. He is not here. He is risen, as he said. Come, see the place where the Lord lay. And go quickly and tell his disciples that he is risen from the dead. And behold, he goeth before you into Galilee. There ye shall see him. Lo, I have told you. And they departed quickly from the sepulchre with fear and great joy, and did run to bring his disciples word. And as they went to tell his disciples, behold, Jesus met them, saying, "All hail." And they came and held him by the feet and worshipped him. Then said Jesus unto them, "Be not afraid. Go tell my brethren that they go into Galilee, and there shall they see me." Now when they were going, behold, some of the watch came into the city, and showed unto the chief priests all the things that were done. And when they were assembled with the elders and had taken counsel, they gave large money unto the soldiers, saying, "Say ye, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we slept. And if this come to the governor's ears, we will persuade him and secure you." So they took the money and did as they were taught, and this saying is commonly reported among the Jews until this day. Then the 11 disciples went away into Galilee, into a mountain where Jesus had appointed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and spake unto them, saying, "All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. Amen." I don't have a lot of comments to make on this section. It's a very interesting story because of the desperate attempts to conceal the truth, or to at least send a story out there that's not the truth, that the Jews went through. And again, there's other details in this final passage that other gospels will tell you. How the disciples ran into the tomb and different things like that. But I think we'll just leave it at that. A couple of things that you'll notice is that the people that knew that Jesus was alive had no trouble believing it. Later in the book of Acts and even up into our time, people are giving their lives because they believe that Jesus is alive. How do we know that Jesus is alive? How do you know? Well, isn't it because those of us who have believed in Jesus really do have some of his life within us? That we know through his spirit that he is alive. And in conclusion, I want to just leave you with these thoughts. Jesus loved us with a love that does not have any reason. We always have a reason for loving, either because a person loved us first, or because they have helped us, and so we find in our hearts that, and I believe humans can have unselfish love. I believe that we can, and yet there's always a reason that we love that person. I think I'm safe in saying that. God had no reason to love us. He was an offended, divine being, and he loved us anyway. And so Jesus' love is the kind of love that will take betrayal, it will take denial, it'll take the mocking, it'll take the scourging and the execution. And the question comes to me, are we worth that? Well, guess what? God says so. God said that we're worth that. Jesus agreed. And so when we end up this story with the living Lord who said, you're worth that, he says, now I want you to do something for me. I want you to go and tell everybody else about it. And the question is, are your neighbors worth that story? Or aren't they? I say they are. God says that they are because he died for the entire world. And that's what I want to leave us with today is the love. And could we grow in our love toward Christ in some way? And I think the answer, of course, to that is yes as well. Thank you for your attention. And God bless you.